Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. Welcome to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. Today, the move towards a global average diet. Around the world, we're all starting to eat the same thing, and that means the world's farmers are starting to grow the same crops. Today, we look at the push to change all that and bring diversity back to farming. Also ahead, we'll tell you about a couple of serious accidents that left farmers as quadriplegics, one helicopter crash and one car crash. And in both cases, the farmers managed to stay living and working on the land. You can hear how they did it later today on Bush Telegraph. Just how important is your vote? That's a question that many regional South Australians will ponder this weekend. The ABC's election analyst Anthony Green has picked 22 seats which will determine the outcome of tomorrow's South Australian election, but only two of those are outside of Greater Adelaide. And during the campaign, rural and regional issues have hardly rated a mention. Dean Jench is a political analyst from Flinders University. Hi, Dean.
Good morning.
Why are the votes of people living outside of Adelaide seemingly so irrelevant to the outcome of this state election?
A number of reasons, but the first one is quite simple. It's due to the demography of South Australia. We're the most centralised state of all. We have about 80 to 85% of the people live in the greater metropolitan area. Now, if the electoral system is one vote, one value, which ours is and it should be, then what you've got is 34 seats in the metropolitan area and 13 in the regional area. Now, if you think of the numerics of that, elections are won and lost in the metropolitan area. Now, that's the first point. The second point is that of those 13 in the rural areas, 12 of them are rock-solid non-Labor. There's only one electorate in the whole of regional South Australia which is currently held by the Labor Party, and that's based on the city of Whyalla, the industrial city of Whyalla. The rest of them are rock-solid Liberal or Independent. Now, given that, there's not going to be much interest in either the minds of Labor or Liberal in going out and trying to win votes in the rural areas, simply because the rural voters are far too predictable. They, for generations, have voted non-Labor, and they will continue to vote non-Labor. Now, the Liberal Party's not going to put much effort into those seats. They're going to win them anyway. The Labor Party's not going to put much effort and interest into those seats because they're going to lose them anyway.
But if you look at other states around Australia and even the federal system, that's where we've seen the rise of the rural independent that's attracted local votes, often campaigning on local issues. Have we seen that in South Australia?
To a minor degree. There are two of the rural seats are held by independents. One is probably going to go back to the Liberal Party this time. The other one will probably continue to be held by the Independents. But the one difference is, and if you compare us to Western Australia, fortuitously, the regional people in Western Australia elected National Party representatives, sufficient of them, and again, fortuitously, they won a balance of power. Now, if you look for what came out of that, and that was the royalties for regions, the regional areas of Western Australia have done very well, thank you. But the problem in South Australia is that there is this utter stability of voting, of patterns of voting in the regional areas, and I think that's the explanation.
So rural people in some ways are getting what they deserve?
Well, no, they're not. I mean, there's two ways of defining that. They're not getting what they deserve in one sense. And that is deep interest from whichever party is in government, simply because the votes in the rural areas are just utterly predictable. So my solution's always been, until regional voters start to give the indication that they're willing to put their votes up for sale, and that is just they're going to vote for whichever party offers them the best alternative set of policies in terms of regional issues, then they're not going to get anywhere. So what they need to do is shed their deep party identification, become swinging voters, and put their votes up for sale.
Any indication that will happen tomorrow?
No, it won't happen tomorrow. What we're going to see is, out of the 13 seats, 12 of them in the rural areas, 12 of them will go to non-Labor, most of it to the Liberal Party. One of the electorates, the Whyalla electorate, is up for grabs, could go either way, but it's going to be a very stable result. And I think that really is the problem for regional voters.
In terms of policy, though, what does that mean for regional voters? What will be the consequence of that outcome?
Well, the consequences are that policies... think of political human nature. If you're in government or you're in opposition and you're formulating policies, you're going to direct those policies to the people whose votes you have some opportunity of winning at the next election. So your policies will be directed to where the marginal seats are, where the swinging voters are, and where the most voters are. And what we're talking about is metropolitan policies. Now, both parties, of course, will couch that in national terms. They'll say, look, these policies will increase the economic health not only of the cities but of the rural areas, etc., etc. But essentially, they're directing their attention and their policies to where the votes are. And that is just political human nature.
What actually are the big talking points, the big issues for rural South Australians?
Well, the big issues for rural South Australia is firstly the economic health of rural South Australia. The Labor government, the Wetherill government, is pushing very hard in terms of rural South Australia will benefit a lot from what Labor's calling an explosion in mining, which is going to occur in South Australia. Now, that really had a solid slump when the Roxby Downs, the massive expansion of Roxby Downs just was stopped by BHP, so Olympic Dam is not going to go ahead in terms of expansion.
Was the state government counting on that going ahead, do you believe?
Very much so. Mm. The state government was using that to say that this is an indication that the economic health of South Australia, and that includes regional economic health, will massively improve once the Olympic Dam project starts. And now the Olympic Dam project hasn't started, and is being delayed for nobody knows how long. That argument's gone out the window. The closure of Holden's is certainly going to affect the metropolitan area, but equally it may well affect some of the regional areas in terms of a flow-on of the economic downturn.
Is anyone talking about water and the Murray-Darling Basin in particular?
Well, not very much at the moment, because the Murray-Darling Basin... currently, for South Australia at least, is in a healthy situation. South Australians talked about the Murray-Darling Basin when we were desperately short of water, when we were in the middle of the drought, when there was very little water coming down the Murray. And the Labor Party, Labor government, built a massive desalination plant. They're not using it to the extent they should. They're still drawing out of the Murray because it's cheaper. But what it's done is taken the issue of water off the agenda for South Australians. They don't perceive any great crisis in water at the moment.
So this weekend is the real interest in what happens in the upper house rather than the lower house?
Yes, there is an interest in what happens in the upper house. The upper house is a hung parliament. Labor, Liberal and a clutch of independents have approximately one third of the seats each. And that will be the same thing after this election. It's the one prediction that can be made definitely, and that is the upper house will be another hung parliament. So the clutch of independents, it depends on just what sort of independents get elected. And there's no doubt at all that it could go something like the Senate with some rather odd independents being elected, because we do have a single statewide electoral system and a quota of a very low quota for election, only about 8%. So we could see some different independents emerging. But the upper house is... it's the second most powerful upper house in the British Commonwealth, so it does have a say on what gets through.
Why is it so powerful?
Well, it's powerful because it was set up in 1857 as a house which had absolute power over any legislation brought in by a government, and that's never been changed.
OK, well, we'll see what happens on the weekend. Thanks a lot, Dean. Appreciate it.
Okay, pleasure.
Professor Dean Jench, political analyst from Flinders University. This is Bush Telegraph on RN. Tony Allen joins me now for today's Rural News. Tony, the trouble in Ukraine has caused some changes in world commodity markets. The wheat price is one of those. What's happening?
Yeah, things are looking pretty good for some Australian commodities at the moment. With wheat, there's a surge in global wheat prices. The Chicago wheat futures have jumped 25% in the past 6 weeks. And the forward prices for the Australian harvest have added about $35 a tonne to be trading at around $300 a tonne. So that's encouraging for our farmers. It's largely due to two things, concern that the US winter wheat crop might be damaged, but also political uncertainty around the Black Sea region, which is a big producer of wheat. Mm-hmm. Luke Matthews from the Commonwealth Bank says many growers are making the most of this price rally for wheat and they're locking in their futures contracts.
That seems to be a critical level for a lot of growers out there. If prices that they have on offer look around that $300 a tonne mark, they start to lock in some of those prices. So we are seeing opportunities here locally, and more broadly it's just helping provide a little bit of confidence to the Australian grain grower in the lead up to the planting season.
Okay, the uncertainty around Ukraine's also affecting resources?
Well, you know, gold is one of those commodities that when things start looking a bit dodgy anywhere, people buy gold.
The safe haven, is it?
The safe haven. Yeah. I was trying to avoid the cliche. but yes, the safe haven. And the gold price has risen recently to above $1,300 an ounce. And there's also a disappointing outlook for growth in China. So the worry about China, as well as the tensions in Ukraine, are encouraging people to move to gold, and in turn that's encouraging the Australian gold industry. John Walton is a supervisor at a gold mine on the outskirts of Cloncurry in North Queensland, and he says all the mines that are looking to explore and expand are reaping the benefits of this steady price climb for gold.
When you're mining it at up to 10 ounces per tonne, for the plant to cover its cost you're looking at $800 an ounce. At the 1300 is very, very profitable. It's a slow and steady rise. And exploration for gold is always prolific in the North Queensland and the Charters Towers area, those areas. So it will give a kick to exploration.
Hmm. Even a generalist knows that gold prices go up when there's uncertainty, but not everyone knows that leads to exploration around rural areas. So thanks, Tony. Appreciate it. Tony Allen with Rural News. You have a good weekend. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Cameron Wilson with you.
On Background Briefing, the trouble with environmental offsets.
If you bowl over some bush somewhere, you've got to get an equivalent gain somewhere else. It's that simple.
But offsets are being approved that are nowhere near like for like.
The area that we looked at, the maps are just completely wrong.
And the result is just what was supposed to be avoided.
You knock off this, you do it over the country, and before you know it, this stuff's gone. And every single species that we rely on, it's gone too.
Background Briefing, Sunday morning after 8.
Right now, you're listening to Bush Telegraph around Australia on RN and across Asia and the Pacific on Radio Australia. You'll often hear this from travellers, that the world's cities are becoming the same. The same chain stores selling the same brands, the buildings all look the same, and even the local television shows are often part of a global franchise. This decline in diversity is also happening in food. Wheat, maize and soybean crops are replacing millet, sorghum and rice. The report, Increasing Homogeneity, found the trends towards a Western diet has big implications for nutrition and food security. Colin Currie from the International Centre for Tropical Agriculture says all nations are coming together towards a global average diet, and he told Greg Muller this trend has developed over the past 50 years.
Generally, around the world, all nations are coming together towards what you might call a global average diet. What we did in our research is we looked at diets around the world at the national level. That is, for each country, what kind of crops are people eating and how much of each crop are people eating in their diet. And that dietary contribution was the calories, or protein, fat, overall weight in the diet. And what we found is that around the world, people are starting to eat more and more of the same crops, with a particular group of crops becoming more and more important.
So what's driven that?
What's driven it is a complicated group of a number of factors that all come together. What I understand is that rising incomes around the world, that's greater purchasing power. This is as a global trend, so especially in areas where people didn't have as much purchasing power in the past, are able to access a greater amount of food. Meanwhile, people are moving into the cities, they're urbanizing. That means they have less gardens, they have less access to wild plants, they eat out more, they have access to supermarkets, they eat fast food, and they cook less at home, they have less time for cooking at home. Another aspect is globalization in its broad sense, which means a greater amount of food, ideas, cultures moving around the globe. That also entails freer trade agreements between countries of moving goods and commodities. It means supermarkets, global supermarkets or global food industries entering countries.
But are we just choosing the crop varieties that are giving higher yields, considering we have to feed, 9 billion people by 2050? Aren't we just selecting the crops that are most likely able to give us that?
Yes, absolutely. I do think that that's part of it. If you consider that the great majority of research investment, both from the public sector and from the private sector, has gone into a couple of select crops in the last 50 years, particularly soybean, maize, wheat and rice, sugar to some degree, we've been phenomenally successful at making those crops more productive and in the end cheaper to people. And the greatest trend that we saw in our research was really the oil crops, particularly soybean, palm oil. These are crops that basically didn't exist at the global level 50 years ago and have become vital parts of the diet because they're cheap plant fats for cooking mostly. Now, when you ask whether we're only choosing because they're more productive, I think it's also the other direction. They're more productive because we put a lot of energy into them. And I would guess that if we put a lot more energy into alternative crops, we could actually have some pretty quick high gains in those alternative crops as well. It's a matter of priorities, really.
So as we see the globe moving towards a more Western environment, you're right that Western health problems are spreading globally as well. Like you say, the number of overnourished now has surpassed the number of undernourished people.
Yeah, quite a change, really, a historical change in the world.
Why is that the case?
Underneath, or one could say above this trend that we see in changes in crops, is the larger trend that people are eating overall more food. That is more calories, more fat, more protein. And within that, they tend to be eating more energy-dense food. That's high fat, high sugar, high calorie food. What that means is that the overall amount of energy in the body is more, and if we're not burning it off, we store that as fat and we become obese. And then we end up with an increased likelihood of dietary-related diseases of cholesterol and diabetes, and heart disease. We think that these trends that we're seeing in terms of crops, this narrowing and increased homogeneity of particular crops, is only going to increase the likelihood of that similar pattern happening. And this pattern, I should mention, is not just a pattern of countries, the United States, Australia, the UK, that have experienced these nutrition transition for quite a long time. It's everywhere now. In Nigeria, in China, there are issues even in the same regions, the same communities, where we have issues of dietary disease from overnutrition just as much as from undernutrition.
Well, I was shocked to read that wheat is one of the most prominent foods in 97% of countries.
Yeah, pretty phenomenal.
So what are the grains that we're not growing now? What are we missing out on?
So the greatest change in diets around the world that we've seen have been in sub-Saharan Africa and in East Asia. And in sub-Saharan Africa, we can talk about these regionally important grains. These are sorghum, the millets, as well as tuber crops such as yams, sweet potatoes. These are the sort of crops that used to be quite important. And they're still around, but they become more marginalized. They're less important in the diet as some of these other commodities have gained importance. In East Asia, we see some of these same processes, for instance, with sweet potato declining, some of the millets. But we also see rice itself becoming a little less important in the diet in East Asia as wheat and potatoes and other than main globalized commodities come in.
So what about vegetables?
They mostly stay about the same. They're not declining highly, they're not increasing highly, but around them, the oil crops and these particular cereals like wheat and maize are increasing in abundance greatly.
What's the role of multinational food organizations then in standardizing our food?
Multinational food organizations have done considerable work in moving new products, and I think particularly processed products around the world. And that's brought food that's can often be cheaper and also easier to cook or process to more people, available in supermarkets, And so people will eat products, and they have some crops within them that they know about. Maybe it's a tomato sauce and it's got tomato, and it also has some other products that we might not be as aware of what's in them. That might be sugar that comes from maize. It might be soybean oil. And that all builds up, of course, in the diet. It adds up to a diet where we're eating more soy or more maize than we thought.
The other outcome of us all eating the same thing is we have less diversity of microbacteria in our gut.
Yeah, this is an interesting trend that's being seen in the literature. They've been able to look at people's remains over time, as well as modern history of gut diversity or tooth diversity, as mouth diversity, and see that changes in our diets over time, particularly in eating, let's say, simpler foods, that is, more sugary foods, more simple carbohydrates, has changed the balance of organisms, both in the gut and in the mouth, both to some negative degree.
What do you mean negative degree? Why is this a bad thing?
As an ecologist, how I understand this trend is that whether it's in one's mouth, whether it's in one's stomach, whether it's in a natural system or an agroecosystem, a balance of diversity, that is some level of numerous amount of species, creates a balance that creates resilience in the system. When one has only one or a few species, more vulnerable to change, if some big change happens, a diet that is higher in sugar seems to end up with bacteria and microbiota that are abundantly dominated by types that eat those sugars. And that system is less balanced and less resilient in the end to change.
I guess likewise, focusing on fewer crop varieties, we're opening ourselves to be more vulnerable to diseases or drought.
This is our main implication coming from an agricultural research institute, is that necessarily if we're eating more of the same types of crops around the world, the same crop species, then necessarily in our agricultural systems, we're growing more of those crops. And that means we're either producing them at home and eating them more, or we're importing them. In either case, in the global sum, it's less diversity in global production areas. And that means greater vulnerability to major pest and disease outbreaks. And so we think that if we're going to grow a less diversity of crop species, it's ever more important to have diversity within those crops. That is, many varieties grown with distinct characteristics, so that the kind of episodes that we learned from, hopefully, in the Irish potato famine, in the southern corn leaf blight in the United States in the 70s, where we had only a few varieties being grown and they were highly susceptible to certain pests, so that sort of event won't happen again. And of course, if that event happened again, the more and more people relying on those sort of systems, the more are going to be affected. I was thinking today about the Ukraine and reading about it. And the Ukraine is one of the largest exporters in the world of wheat and maize. And so not only is this an issue, of course, of pests and diseases and diversity, but if we're relying more and more on particular crops, it also means we're relying on a global system of having those available to us. And if our third largest or so provider of those sort of crops has instability within it and are unable to produce as they were, then we may end up with higher food prices, unavailability of those sort of crops.
You're listening to Bush Telegraph, and my guest is Colin Khoury, who's just co-authored a report, Increasing the Homogeneity in Global Food Supplies, the Implication for Food Security. With fewer and fewer crop varieties on the menu globally, what this means for our health and our agricultural systems. Colin, what's the role of climate change?
The science is clear at this point that climate change is affecting agricultural systems and will in the future. And of course, it's not just the changes in temperatures and precipitation in their own right. It's combined with all these other really significant challenges to agriculture in the coming time. That's more people needing to be fed. That's less available land to expand our agricultural areas. That's resource limitations like phosphorus limitations and water limitations. So together with climate change, there's very significant factors affecting the ability to increase our yields in the world in the coming time. And if we're going to rely more and more on these particular crops, once again, it looks like genetic diversity within the crops is really where we need to focus in terms of trying to keep those crops both resilient, but also try to increase yields.
One solution often put up for agricultural pests or drought or lower yields has been genetic modification of crops. What's your view on that?
It's a powerful technique that has potential. What remains to be seen is how that technique is used. What's fairly clear, I think, is that genetic engineering is not a panacea. It's not going to be the solution. And there are cases where we're moving traits from other species can be very powerful and very useful. There was actually a report that came out last week that was the movement of traits resistant to potato blight into a potato variety, and that has been worked on, basically since the Irish potato famine. And they've had some success finally using some of these techniques, but it certainly has potential to help us if we direct research funds that way.
With certain varieties patented, does that add to this problem of standardization?
I would rather say, and thank you for bringing that up, because it comes back to the same point. One of the main issues, though, with genetic engineering or patenting in the overlap is that we are ending up with agriculture being more and more dominated by certain multinational organizations that are doing a lot of the research and owning a lot of the seed. And those organizations are playing their part in feeding the world. But what it can mean is that we may end up with a greater amount of the same varieties, very successful varieties with good traits in them, being grown over larger areas. And that success may create in and of itself a vulnerability. And if we're not aware of that vulnerability and continue to create new varieties, a more diverse amount of varieties, then we may end up in trouble.
We've got quite a trajectory we're heading in now. What would you like to see?
This is an excellent question. What's interesting about the trend that we see is that we're clearly heading in a direction of increasingly similar diets around the world. But I don't think we're going to end up with a static point in which we're all really eating the same thing. It's unlikely to ever arrive at that point, but also in some regions of the world, we're already seeing something else happening, this change. And particularly in Northern Europe and Scandinavia, some isolated pockets in the United States, I'm sure in Australia, where people are making the connection between their diets and diet-related disease, and they're starting to eat a wider range of diet with a greater amount of vegetables and cereals and less oils and fat. And the big question is, how are they doing that? And how can the rest of the world learn from that before we end up with such high level of epidemics of diet-related disease? There is, in the case of Scandinavia at least, there's good evidence that policy has been important in making diverse food cheaper and making imported, unhealthier food a little bit more expensive. And that's a little bit more difficult to imagine, that sort of policy being as extensively done in the United States, perhaps in Australia, because there are different views on how much politics should enter the market. But I can see a role to play to also try to encourage as much as possible a wider diversity of food available to people. And also, of course, to really invest in alternative crops.
Colin Currie from the International Centre for Tropical Agriculture, based in Colombia, speaking there to Greg Muller. That study was published in the National Academy of Sciences, and we'll make sure there's a link to that up on the Bush Telegraph website this afternoon. Angelo Eliadis is concerned about this drop in diversity. Angelo's a horticulturalist who specialises in urban agriculture and is in the middle of a project trying to scale up to larger plots in inner city areas, and this includes looking at planting non-traditional varieties. Hi, Angelo.
G'day.
The extent of the decline in crop variety that we just heard about there, does that surprise you at all?
No, because essentially if you treat plants as a commodity rather than a basic human need, and essentially if you're running an industrial process, what you want is a small but highly productive series of products that you're focused on rather than spreading yourself too thin. So from a basic industrial process model, that is essentially the aim of all industrial
specialisation.
Specialisation, exactly.
So what have you done to try to change your food system?
Okay, well, I could say that in the last possibly 5 years, I've been working with a lot of people in the sort of sphere of urban agriculture, and what we've been doing is quite the opposite, because we have, I guess, human health as our primary concern, and also resilience and food security. We've been looking at all different types of foods from all different regions of the world that will grow essentially in Melbourne's climate. It's you can basically call it a series of field trials that have been going for the past 5 to 10 years. And one thing that we've realised, there's a large amount of food plants coming from the Asian region that is essentially untapped. They look at a lot more ecosystems than we do to draw their food from, and just the range is increasing. The other thing that we constantly forget is that most of the rural agriculture is focused on annual plants.
So what's one of your plots? What does it actually look like?
Okay, well, essentially my specialisation is food forest gardening, so it looks essentially like a temperate forest. But we can scale that down to something that looks more like a traditional garden. It's a matter of degrees. But in terms of productivity, typically it'll reach its maximum productivity in about 10 years, but currently I'm getting about 14 to 15 tonnes per acre equivalent. Australian dry land wheat farms only get about 2 to 4, so I'm already outstripping them by factor of several magnitudes there.
So you're feeding more than just yourself?
Oh, definitely. We give away a lot of food.
So what role, though, do small horticulturalists like yourself, what role do they play in maintaining the diversity of crops?
Okay, essentially, what I need to sort of do is pull back on basically some of the presumptions about food production. Essentially, agriculture is about 10,000 years old, and it's primarily been the prerogative and the sovereignty of communities, not businesses. I think agribusiness is only a very modern phenomenon, and essentially communities were acting from a point of what you call enlightened self-interest to keep a diversity of different plants. Like I know in the areas of Mexico, there was thousands of varieties of corn, and with modernisation, they've whittled them away to almost nothing, and now they're trying to regain them.
But these days we go off to work, a lot of us go off to work in offices and spend our time eating out and have busy lives, so it's not really practical in that sense to think of us as spending great amounts of time trying to be specialists or specialise in growing our own food as well.
Definitely not, but every little part plays. I've got some interesting statistics from National Gardening Association, it's a US organisation. And they produced a paper in 2009 called Garden Market Research, The Impact of Home and Community Gardening in America. And there's some very startling statistics that came out. Apparently, back in 2009, there was 36 million households with an average 600 square foot garden. That's about 60 square metres, producing half a pound of fresh produce per square foot of area. In other words, 300 pounds, about 150 kilos out of each garden. Now, if we actually look at what that means, that is essentially
That doesn't equate to small gardens and urban agriculture and horticulture feeding 9 billion people, though, surely.
This is an average. They basically surveyed all or as many of the American householders who are basically growing produce. Now, they were spending $70 on inputs, and their return on investment was $530. So that's about a 750% return on investment. And if I give you the figures of what they actually were producing in terms of dollar value, it's quite striking. They, for a total input investment of $2.5 billion across those 36 million people, they returned a total investment of $21 billion of produce. Now, I've looked at Australia's ABS statistics for gross value of agricultural commodities produced, just across vegetables and fruit and nuts. That's about $6 million. So
we're talking about big, big numbers. A lot to think about. Angelo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
Angelo Iliadis, who is a horticulturalist specialising in urban agriculture. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Charlie McGee is a musician and a permaculture advocate. If you're a long-term listener to Bush Telegraph, you might recognise his name or his band's name, Formidable Vegetable Sound System. They try to get people more interested in growing their own food through song. Songs like this one. This is called There's No Such Thing as Waste.
When I was a little boy, I liked to catch the rain, while people all around my town watched it flow right down the drain. But 'cause our little shed in the bush wasn't on the main, the only water we had to use was in a tank or from the rain. 'Cause there's no such thing as waste. only stuff in the wrong place. No, there's no such thing as waste. Misusing water's a disgrace. Moved to the city, rented a house on my way to buy a bed. Saw one lying on the side of the road, so I took that one instead. And also found a fridge, a couch, and a big old plasma screen, and the biggest pile of thrown out stuff that I had ever seen. But there's no such thing as waste, oh no. Only stuff in the wrong place, yeah. That's right, there's no such thing as waste. That old landfill is a disgrace. Found out that diesel cars can run on veggie fat. Bought a truck and hit the road, smelling like fish and chips. I rescued piles of wasted oil from the back of restaurants. I'd be a fool if I bought my fuel when there's oil nobody wants. Cause no such thing as waste, oh no. Only stuff in the wrong place, yeah. I said there's no such thing as waste. That old idea's gotta be replaced. Now we gotta refuse, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle. Refuse, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle. Now I get my things out of garbage bins and I compost every crumb. I save my seeds and eat my weeds and feed the leftovers to your mum. Gonna build a house from the rubbish tip, gonna keep this planet clean. Reuse ideas that have been around for years to live within its means. Cause there's no such thing as waste, oh no. Only stuff in the wrong place. Squeed it and bit it, bit it. I said there's no such thing as waste.
No such thing as waste. Charlie McGee and the Formidable Vegetable Sound System. If you like that, they've got plenty of songs about permaculture from the album Permaculture, a Rhymer's Manual that came out last year. You're listening to RN and Radio Australia. Earlier this week, we heard that farms are incredibly dangerous workplaces, and every year dozens of farmers die or are left disabled after accidents. That begs a question. How can people living with disabilities manage to remain productive on the farm? Rob Cook was in a chopper crash at Supaljack, a remote cattle station in the Northern Territory, and Sam Bailey was involved in a car crash as a jackaroo. Both suffered horrific injuries, which have left them with significant disabilities, and both are still farming. Hi, Rob, what happened to you?
Yeah, g'day, mate. We were mustering cattle on our family back in September 2008, and everything was going to plan. We were doing having a good, clean, straight run, and then all of a sudden the helicopter just fell out of the sky. And so when we hit the ground, the way we landed, it broke the C4 vertebrae and it kinked the spine.
Yeah.
And so essentially I'm a C4 quadriplegic with no feeling or moving movements from the shoulder down.
No movement?
No, not at all. I've got enough movement in my right shoulder, which gives me the ability, if someone puts my hand on the joystick of a powered wheelchair, I can, in a very weird way, move the wheelchair around.
Sam, your accident was a little longer ago. What happened in your situation?
Yeah, mine was back in 1987. I was, preparing to come back to the farm. I'd just got out of school and thought I'd have a couple of years out in the big wide world to grow up and learn a few tricks before I got home. And anyway, I was, as you just said, jackarooing a cattle station up in the Northern Territory, and three of my mates and I thought we'd climb into a car and bust the boredom of a Sunday afternoon by heading back into a little place called Kenwell for a beer. And anyway, we had the accident. We had a blowout in the front passenger side, tore up the car, and the car flipped over. And I'd never seatbelt on, was thrown out the back window, and I, like Rob, I broke my neck. I'm a little bit further down, though, so I've got a little bit more movement than Rob. But Yeah, look, it was, you know, obviously it turns your life upside down and inside out at that age when you're sort of 6 foot tall and bulletproof with the world at your feet. As I discovered, and Rob discovered, your life can change, and it can change very, very quickly. And so I had my accident, and you know, it had always been a lifelong dream of mine to get back into the bush. And, you know, it was in my blood and it was under my fingernails, I think, when I came out of the womb, and it was all I wanted. And
you must have thought that was over, though. That option might have been out of the question.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. Yeah, first thing I thought is, you know, there goes that dream. And so I had 5 months in a spinal unit in Brisbane, and where you literally start all over again. And I remember one day I was talking to my occupational therapist, and she said to me, "Now, Sam, what are you thinking once you get out the doors?" And I remember saying, "I'm going to go home and farm." And I do remember a stark silence there. And I think she, her perception of agriculture was a primary and a physical occupation. And I think she was wondering how in the hell,
how's this going to happen?
It was going to go back home. And so I think back then, as I just said, their perception was it was a physical occupation, and how are you going to do it?
Rob, what about you? Did you think your days on the property might be over?
Well, look, there was a time when I was in intensive care. I was in there for 3 months, and 11 weeks of that I was on life support, and it wasn't until the doctors made it very clear to me that if I don't learn to breathe on my own, I'm going to be on a ventilator for the rest of my life. And that was just never an option, you know. My mum and dad and my beautiful wife, Sarah, they said, "Look, you can do this, and if you don't, you're going to have to carry a bottle around with you." And so that was a big turning point for me, and it took a few weeks after that to wean myself off the ventilator. And once I started breathing on my own again, I thought, well, you know, what the doctors tell you can't do, sometimes they can be a little bit mistaken. And so from that day on, it was just a dead set ambition and goal to get home and to be a part of the family farming business.
So was the aim to get back to the property, or was it to get back and be working on the property?
No, it was always to get back and be productive, you know. And I didn't understand back in the rehab days, just how much I could or couldn't do, you know. I knew that I could talk on the telephone, and I could talk to people, and the cattle industry is something that I know, and, you know, I thought there would be a opportunity for me or a position for me, but I didn't know how or where or when or what, and it wasn't until later on when I started studying that I realised that there, you know, you can manage a property from the veranda.
Mm. What do you actually do now, Rob?
Well, right now we've moved over to a little grazing property over in Queensland. We've only got 100 head of breeders at the moment. But essentially everything from, you know, fixing broken down machinery to mustering and drafting cattle, I can still do all that verbally, and all I need is, you know, willing people around me to help out, and we can still overcome anything. You know, to give you an example, we had a clutch that was slipping in a truck, and I had a couple of girls here helping me, and they just got up with the iPhone, filmed it, and then brought it back to me, and I said, "Look, these," I paused at the right spot and said, "These are the bolts here. I want you to pull out," and you know, we were able to fix the clutch. So,
can you instruct anyone to fix any machinery? Can you?
Well, I believe so. Yeah. I can't see why not. So long as they're not afraid to have a go, I think anything's possible.
I'm going to start taking photos of problems I've got around the house and sending them through to you, I think.
Yeah.
Is it, be good. What can't you do?
Well, I can't scratch my nose. If I've got phlegm on my chest, I can't cough that up on my own. But as far as what I can't do, I don't believe there's anything. So long as I can get to the job, I believe with people that are keen to have a go around me, that I can achieve anything. You know, from building frames, like right now we're building a set of yards to go around a pump in the dam, and you know, it's just a matter of poking along. And I know how to do things, I just can't do it myself. So over the time, I've learned a little bit of patience and how to instruct people the right way around me. And that's probably what been the biggest learning curve that I've had since the accident.
Mm. Sam, what about you? What do you actually do day to day on the property now?
We've got 3,000 acres here. It's just it's sort of a cabbage patch from where Rob's from. But we, Jen and I here, and look, I'm able to ride a four-wheel motorbike, so I do all the mustering and, but it's then just all the, checking fences and starting pumps and pumping water and it is amazing what you can do, if you want to. I mean, when I first got home, I couldn't do anything, but I taught myself to ride a bike and, modified all the machinery and designed a little hoist to get me into the cabins, all of the, the gear we've got here. So basically, you can do anything if you want to. And Rob's just a magnificent role model in that field that I think, and I'm a bit the same. We run a cattle operation here. Well, I've got a full motorbike and, I can use a phone. I've got a good stock agent and I'm a bit like Rob too. Jen's my sort of right hand man, and she, I've had to teach her all the things with the machinery, and again pulling things apart and putting them back together. And sometimes that goes well, and sometimes it doesn't. But I think it's just having the belief that you can do it. And I think once you achieve something, it just spurs you on, and then you get to a stage, as Rob just said, well, you can do anything. You just got to think another way of doing it.
Sam, did you actually build and design the machinery you needed?
Yeah, I think. Farmers are pretty amazing people. I mean, a farmer is an engineer, an auto electrician, a mechanic, all in one. And you give a farmer a bit of steel and a welder and a grinder, he'll make something of it. And I think, it was a bit frustrating early on because there was no, when I first got home, I tried to bring around and find some information of anyone that ever done, particularly when I was sort of thinking of modifying machinery and designing a hoist. I thought to myself, oh, surely someone's done this before, but... way back then, it hadn't been done. So I really had to, you've really got to sort of nut it out yourself. And I suppose that's what we did between Dad and I and a few mates and a guy that was working for us at the time. We just sort of, you'd do a few prototypes, and most of the time the first one wouldn't work, but gradually you nut it out. I was a bit lucky. Most of the machines we had on the farm were all hand-controlled anyway. Mm. We had to just engineer a couple of clutches and a couple of old tractors that we had to, build a hand clutch. But for me, the biggest thing, my biggest challenge was getting from ground level up into the cabins, and eventually we sort of solved that problem by putting a little plastic seat on the end of a little crane, and that enabling you to get up in the cabin. I knew once I was up there.
Once you're in, you're right, yeah.
Because we'd have a harvest. It was about the first year I got home, and I drove the header there for harvest, but my brother, he had to give me a sort of fireman's lift up into the cabin, and at the end of the harvest, he said, mate, I love you dearly, but you've bugged my back, and you're going to have to think of a different way of getting up there, so... So I devised this little hoist, and that solved the problem.
And away you went. That's Sam Bailey speaking there. We're hearing from Sam Bailey and Rob Cook, both farmers who have had serious accidents on their properties and are now living and working as farmers, as quadriplegics. You're on Bush Telegraph. Earlier this morning, I spoke to Tony Lower. Tony's the director of the Australian Centre for Agricultural Health and Safety. That's at the University of Sydney. And I was asking him about how farmers can adjust after a serious accident, what sort of support is out there to help them do that?
On a more general term, most farmers, when they are injured, will actually work through a real rehabilitation consultant, and that rehabilitation consultant will actually assist them in trying to get back to work and maintain as much independence as they can. From within our centre, we also have a project called the Agribility Project, which is based on some work which has come out of America. And it effectively is a series of ideas that's based on information provided by farmers and for farmers who have unfortunately suffered some sort of disability. And then that's glossed over by some input by some of these expert rehabilitation providers. to make sure that we're providing the best information that we can, and that's available on our website.
What type of things can be done to modify the operation or to approach farming in a different way?
Yeah, look, I think if people have a look at our website, which is available at aghealth.org.au, there's a number of different scenarios which have been put in place by disabled farmers, and they include some really simple things, but effectively around hoist for moving equipment and or themselves, getting in and out of vehicles, adapting vehicles so that they can be used in relation to the disability that they may have, and even simple things like how to actually produce gate latches that are simple and easy to use for people with significant disabilities.
Where do you get all the information from? Where do these ideas, these innovations stem from?
Well, many of the ideas have stemmed from the farmers themselves. I mean, I think we realise farmers are a really ingenious group of people, and we know that necessity is the mother of all invention. And a lot of these ideas have come straight from farmers and are being used by other farmers. So it's really straight from one source to another.
Okay, so where's all the money for this come from, the funding?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, the program hasn't been funded since 2008. So effectively, it's been in a bit of a halt since that period. However, we know that there really is an unmet demand out there for this, because even though we're not out there promoting the AgriBility site widely at all, we're still getting over 8,000 downloads of information off the system each year. And one of the pieces of information, which is particularly for rehabilitation consultants, many of whom may not be familiar with farming and the activities that are involved in farming, has been downloaded even last year around 600 times. So we know that there is an unmet demand for this. And we hope that we can at one point in time reinvigorate the whole system.
So due to a lack of funds, some of the information hasn't been updated for 5 or 6 years now. So there'd be innovations that are out there that aren't now listed?
Yes, that's correct. And I think if we've got listeners out there that have new ideas, we'd really welcome those ideas, and that we can put them up on the website. And look, I think the more ideas that we have, the better it is for people who are in a whole range of different situations.
Tony Lower, the Director of the Australian Centre for Agricultural Health and Safety at the University of Sydney. Also with me, Rob Cook and Sam Bailey, both farmers who have had serious accidents on the farm but have made sure they stay in the business. Rob Cook, we just heard there that the website that shares some of this information hasn't been updated for quite a few years. Is there a network of farmers living with disabilities out there that you share your ideas, your innovations together?
Look, to be honest, it is quite limited in Australia from what I've come across. Certainly, when you compare it to other countries, you know, essentially the US is just out of control. But, you know, I think most of my networking comes through the phone, and Sam Bailey's just been an amazing example to me and my family about getting on with life on the farm. And so I don't know that the networking is there, you know, certainly not to the level where it probably should be. I know that outside of Sam, I sort of felt like I was on my own and I was sort of flogging a dead horse for a long time. And that's when that Nuffield Scholarship came into play, and it just opened my eyes to what's really out there.
Sam, have you felt that you've had to provide mentoring for farmers that have been in a similar situation to yourself?
Yeah, I have, and I've really enjoyed that. And it's, you know, I love helping people, and if I can, you know, particularly because it's you know, getting back to the farm, just more than being a farm, it's a lifestyle, it's a love, and I think it is, you know, I think, as I said probably a little bit there before, that, you know, it's got to start at a grassroots level too. I think you've got to have a lot of these, you know, a lot of therapists. I think they've sort of got to be trained to be known that, you know, if someone's in a spinal and they want to go back to a farm, well, you know, they can. And but I helped set up that AgriBility with a girl called Kate Borden, and it was amazing, you know, what came out of the woodwork. And it's a crying shame that it sort of hasn't kept going. 2006, was that?
2008, last funding. Yeah, so it's been a while now.
Because, you know, I think technology's come a long way since then as well, and it's just a shame that there aren't. You know, it hasn't kept going because it was a great resource, and I knew a lot of, you know, it was somewhere that I could direct people to go to, and because every disability is a different one,
and different,
you know, what works for me won't work for Rob and vice versa, and, you know, it was a pool of resources that you could just log into. And
well, Sam, we haven't even touched on your plans to fly a chopper and all the other things you're doing in your life, but we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot. All the best with things, Sam.
Yeah, right. Thanks.
Sam Bailey, a farmer, is also writing a book called You Don't Need Wings to Fly. And Rob, thanks for joining us as well. Rob Cook, who's a farmer and the author of When the Dust Settles, his story as well. That's the program for today and for the week. Thanks to the entire Bush Telegraph team. I'll see you on Monday. Stay on RN now for news.